This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
Okay, Parmenides. Parmenides has written a poem. And the poem, interestingly, purports to be a revelation from a goddess. Now, that doesn't seem right with these ancient Greek philosophers. We thought that they were interested in developing a purely rational way of looking at the world. We wouldn't think that they'd be interested in goddesses. But, of course, Parmenides' poem is a fictional poem. There really wasn't any goddess. And what happens is, of course, that the goddess engages in rational argumentation. So the goddess is really a reflection of Parmenides' own mind. And Parmenides is mainly interested in showing us the reflection of his own thought. Well, what does the goddess tell us? The goddess reveals that being is. Okay, remember when I told you that metaphysics is the study of being? Metaphysics is the study of being as being. Well, this is a pretty good example of early metaphysics, a man trying to speak generally about what being is, not about the material composition of being, the way Thales and Anaximenes did and so on, but about the way that we understand being and the characteristics of being. And the first truth, then, is that being is, okay? It's a contradiction to say that being is not. And this is where Parmenides puts his money. Being is, non-being is not. There is no such thing as non-being, okay? Now, you know, think about that a little bit. You might say that zebras exist, but unicorns do not. Zebras inhabit, we might say, being, the world of being, but unicorns don't. Well, that's not quite true. Unicorns don't have what we would call material being. But unicorns exist in literature, don't they? Unicorns exist in fiction. Unicorns play an important part, not a real important part, but they play a part in the intellectual history of human beings. So everything, I mean, you know, think of unicorns, think of Starship Enterprise, think about Hamlet, think about all these beings and that we consider to be fictional, they still have some kind of being. Can you think of anything that has no being at all? It's really impossible to think of anything that has no being, because once you think of something, you're thinking of something that exists, right? So everything is, everything has being. There's nothing that doesn't have being. That's the first insight, and that's what Parmenides thinks is the most important. Therefore, what Parmenides says is that negation, when we use the word not, when we say that this table is brown, not blue, the word not is meaningless. Because not designates non-being, and there's no such thing as non-being. Now, that's a little bit hard to take. I mean, it seems that we've made a leap here. We've made a stretch here from saying that everything has some kind of being to saying that not is a meaningless expression. But let's just follow Parmenides along here. Parmenides thinks that whenever you say green is not blue, you're denying to blue part of the being that's in green. Okay, so it's always a matter of being and non-being. Non-being just doesn't seem to make any sense. Hegel once told his disciples to do this experiment: close your eyes and think being. Now close your eyes and think non-being. What's the difference between them? Probably none. Probably your idea of being in general and your idea of non-being in general are indistinguishable. So, you know, if you can't distinguish them, then just throw out one of them and use the term being. This means for Parmenides that there is no such thing as change, okay? For every change is a change from what is to what is not, okay? If something changes from blue to green, then it's changing from blue to not blue, okay? Bill changes from being 18 to being 19, well, that's a change from 18 to not 18. So every change includes negation. And if there can be no negation, then there can't be any change either. Now, the Greeks really had a problem with change. Change seems to be something that challenged their idea of rationality. And maybe we can understand that by saying that whenever we think about something, maybe think about a tree or think about a table, think about a chair, we take a kind of mental snapshot of it so that we can think about it for a while. And that depends on constancy. That means that the chair has to remain a chair for a while so we can think about it. The tree has to remain a tree for a while so that we can think about it. If the tree changed, you know, every 2 seconds from a tree to a chair to a planet to a building to a person, we couldn't get a rational handle on it. We couldn't think about it very well. Change, if you're going to think about something, you have to think about something with a common nature, with a nature that continues over time. And so change messes that all up. And you can't really think about something that's constantly changing. And so Parmenides really, for him, the most important thing is thought. Most important thing is rationality. And if change is something that inhibits rationality, then there can be no change. You say, well, maybe there is change, but we can't think about it. No, no, no. The only way you can tell whether something is real is whether you can think about it. If something's real, that means you can think about it. If you can think about something, that means it's real. So if you can't think about change, if you can't come up with a rational concept of change, if you can't autonomously determine the nature of change, then there can be no change, okay? What my net can't catch isn't fish. You know that expression? What I can't understand is not being, is not real. So there's no negation, there's no change. And we must therefore be living in a world that's very different from the world we think we're living in. We think we're living in a world with lots of change. And we think we're living in a world where there's lots of negation. The chair is not the table. The clock is not me. The ceiling is not the floor. We think that there's a lot of negation, but Parmenides has proven by his autonomous rational intellect that there cannot be any negation, that there can't be any change. And so therefore the real world must be very different from the way it appears to us. Our senses mislead us evidently. We have to choose between our senses and our mind. And if we have to choose between our senses and our mind, we always have to go with the mind, okay? Our senses make mistakes. You know, your eyes are not reliable all the time. You look at the stick in the water with your eyes and it might appear to be bent, but when you go over there, it turns out that the stick is straight. So your eyes mislead you. So this world that you see with your senses, your senses are not reliable. You really live in a very different kind of world. You have to go with your mind as over against your senses. That becomes an important contrast in the history of philosophy. You have some philosophers who go with their senses, and they're called empiricists. And you have other philosophers who go with their mind, and they're called rationalists. Of course, in this sense, every non-Christian philosopher is a rationalist. But in a more narrow sense, you have a distinction between rationalists and empiricists. Well, Parmenides is not an empiricist. Parmenides is a rationalist. And so here's what he thinks the real world is like. Now, this is getting rid of all the negation, getting rid of all the change. Being is like this. Being is ungenerated, indestructible, changeless, homogeneous, that is, it's all made up of the same stuff, indivisible, continuous, that is, there are no parts, because of course parts make it plural, and parts make it mean that something got changed into parts, or the parts change into the whole. Or parts, where you have parts, there are negations between the parts. It can't be any of that. So the real world must be without parts. It must be perfect, okay, because imperfection means that there's a change from perfect to imperfect or imperfect to perfect. Motionless and limited, that may surprise you. You might expect Parmenides to say that it's unlimited or in infinite, okay? See, for the Greeks, infinity is a negative concept. Infinity means that something has no boundaries, and therefore it has no structure, it has no nature, it has no intelligible properties. So Parmenides wants to say the world is limited, that is, it has a rational structure to it, not unlimited, not infinite. You might say, okay, Parmenides, but man, this isn't the world I live in. The world I live in, there's lots of change. You know, I'm changing all the time. I'm getting older, right? Vehicles are moving, and I got to be careful that one of them doesn't move over me. Time keeps changing, and so on. So now Parmenides would say, "Well, you know, you just got to bite that bullet. You know, you have to have the courage of your convictions, and you have to believe that despite the way things appear, that's illusion, and the world is really motionless." Yeah, but you say to Parmenides, how can I live in this changing world if my philosophy denies change? And here Parmenides does something that's a little bit strange. There's one place where Parmenides says, okay, you know, there's another philosophy too that a lot of people live by. And it's not as good a philosophy as mine, but it seems that it's helpful to some people. And we all argue about this. Is Parmenides serious here? Is Parmenides offering this as an alternative philosophy? Is he saying this is another perspective, or is he saying that this is a subpar way of thinking? But anyway, there's the second philosophy that he mentions, in which there's not just one reality, but there are two realities. There's love and hate, and they're fighting one another, and they stir things up, and they get everything moving. And so they explain all the change, and they explain all the process, and so on and so forth. So what's going on there? Is Parmenides saying, I'm not sure that my rational philosophy is right, and now I have to go back and give you the opportunity to take an irrational philosophy. Am I saying that my philosophy is okay up to a point, but doesn't deal with all of life, so we need to supplement it with this irrational philosophy? How is that? But Parmenides, I think, saw that there's something lacking in his perfectly rational scheme, and he needed to supplement it with something else. And I call this section Three Early Alternatives to Parmenides. The three alternatives are Heraclitus, number two, the Atomists, and number three, the Sophists. Okay, Heraclitus, the Atomists, and the Sophists. And I put them down as alternatives to Parmenides because Parmenides, and by the way, they're not exactly in chronological order. Heraclitus is actually a little bit earlier than Parmenides, but I'm more interested in having you understand the conceptual relationships here between these thinkers rather than just the chronological development. Parmenides said, we can kind of bring it down to three things. Parmenides said there is no change. And Parmenides said that there is only one reality being. Parmenides said that human reason is reliable. In fact, it's the supreme guide. Okay, so nothing changes. There's only one reality, and human reason is the supreme guide. Now, I want to tell you that among the Greek philosophers, there were people who disagreed with the first statement, some who disagreed with the second statement, some who disagreed with the third statement. So they didn't just walk around in lockstep. They argued, they debated, they took different positions on things. They disagreed with their predecessors, and they constructed their own schools of thought. Let's look at Heraclitus first of all. Parmenides said there is no change. Heraclitus says everything is changing. Panta re in Greek. Everything flows. And he uses this saying, you cannot step in the same river twice. Usually we take that to mean that if you put your foot in the river, it's moving along, and you take your foot out and the water keeps flowing, and then you put your foot back in again, you're putting your foot into different water. So you're not stepping in the same water, you're stepping in different water, and in a way, the river has changed, so you're not stepping in the same river twice. Actually, that's not quite what Heraclitus said. There are some translation difficulties, but Heraclitus was saying was, even though the water keeps changing all the time, it's still the same river, so we can call it the same river, even though the water is flowing and there's new water all the time. You can see the emphasis of Heraclitus, that everything is flowing. You might look at that wall and say it's pretty stable, it's pretty solid, it's not changing at all. But if you look at it with a microscope, you can see tiny little changes, little tiny bits of matter coming off of it and dust getting onto it and so on. And everything is, and of course, nothing is going to last forever. So everything is constantly changing. So we can't go along with Parmenides. Now, often people say that Heraclitus is an irrationalist, as Parmenides is a textbook example of rationalism, Heraclitus is a textbook example of irrationalism. That, I think, is not appropriate, but I can understand the argument for it. It would seem that if everything is changing all the time, then nothing can be captured by that camera, that metal camera of ours. So nothing can be captured in rational concepts. But Heraclitus makes the statement, everything changes, which presumably is a rational assertion. Heraclitus, if you ask him, do you believe in reason, or do you think reason is useless? Heraclitus would certainly say, I believe in reason. And all the Greeks said that. All Greeks said that the rational life is the good life. Plato, Aristotle, the atomists, even the sophists said that. The rational life is the good life. And so Heraclitus believed that he was just using reason in kind of a sharper, more critical way than somebody like Parmenides. It's reason that tells me that everything changes. We have to account for change. And what Heraclitus does is he says, you know, there must be something in this world that keeps the change in line. There must be something in this world that enables so that the change doesn't exceed certain limits. So the change is limited enough so that we can think about it, so that the change is acceptable to reason. What is it? There's some kind of force in nature that even though everything is constantly changing, we can still think about it, we can still reason about it. And the change seems to progress in an orderly way. Why is it that that change progresses in an orderly way? Heraclitus reasons there is a kind of force called the logos that keeps everything stable, that keeps everything happening according to a rational pattern. Now, you know, that should be interesting to you because if you're a Christian and you're studying as part of a theological program here, you probably know the first chapter of the Gospel of John where John says, in the beginning was the logos, same word. In the beginning was the word, we translate it. In the beginning was the logos, and the logos was with God, and the logos was God. And referring to Jesus Christ, as you see down in verse 14. So people sometimes say, and I think they say this kind of casually, that Heraclitus discovered Christ, or that Heraclitus discovered the Christian God. One of the church fathers said that the Greek philosophers lived according to the logos, and so they lived according to Christ. Well, I think that's a careless way of talking about it, because Heraclitus certainly didn't think of this logos as a person of the Trinity. He didn't believe in the Trinity at all. He didn't think of that in terms of the God of the Bible at all. But he saw the need for some kind of a principle. And it's an impersonal principle. It's an impersonal, rational principle that somehow governs the changing world according to a pattern. But, of course, that's a problem for Heraclitus. Because what if the logos keeps changing too? That would take away the rational structure of the world. It would be one thing on Monday, a different thing on Tuesday, a different thing on Wednesday. So at least the logos has to be constant. The logos has to be unchanging, doesn't it? But how can that be? I mean, the heart of Heraclitus's philosophy, his great insight, is that everything changes. So how can there be any exceptions? How can the logos be something unchanging? So Heraclitus here, he's trying to bridge this gap between an irrationalist view that everything changes and saying, well, not quite everything changes. At least we have a kind of standard, a kind of criterion, a kind of rational principle here. But that rational principle doesn't seem to be adequate, so we jump back up there again. So Heraclitus faces this dialectic, this back and forth between rationalism and irrationalism. The next group of philosophers are known as the atomists. These disagree with Parmenides with regard to monism and pluralism. Okay, I said that Parmenides was a monist. Parmenides believed that there is only one reality. Atomists believe that there are many realities. The atomists believe that there are lots of little things floating around in this universe, and so they become the fathers of pluralism. Now, I've mentioned some names there on the outline, Leucippus, Democritus, very kind of set the foundations for everything. Epicurus, you sometimes hear the word Epicurean used of somebody who likes to eat good food. Well, that's Epicurus is in his ethics. He's an apostle of pleasure or hedonism, if you want. But Epicurus was also an atomist in his metaphysical philosophy. Lucretius was a Latin poet, and then there were qualitative atomists, Empedocles and Anaxagoras, who I won't take time to discuss with you now. But think first of all of Democritus, basically. Democritus follows the primacy of plurality. That is to say, what this world really is vast numbers of tiny atoms. Now, if you're trying to understand the basic nature of the world in philosophy, you can do that in two ways. You can either do it by extrapolating outward to the characteristics of the whole universe, or you can extrapolate inward and downward to the very tiniest realities. And so some philosophers say to understand the world, you need to understand everything in its broad context. You know, you understand these tables in the context of the room, and understand the room in the context of the building, and understand the building in the context of the town, and the state, and the country, and the planet, and so on and so forth, until you have the context of all being. That's sort of what Hegel did, that's sort of what Spinoza did, and sort of what Parmenides did in a way. I mean, he said that you can't really speak intelligibly about individual things. You can only speak about the one thing, which is being. The other way of trying to understand the world is by chopping everything up into little bits, okay? I want to understand this table. Well, first I have to understand the parts of the table. So I chop the table down into tiny little pieces. And I chop those pieces down into tiny little pieces, and those pieces into tinier pieces, until I get to something which is perhaps the tiniest thing that there is, something that's so tiny that I can't chop it anymore, okay? Something that's truly unchoppable. And when I get to that, I've got the ultimate constituent of the world, and I understand the world, right? So that's the logic of it. And the atomists, when they got to, they postulated it. I mean, this is armchair science. They didn't actually chop anything. But they would speculate, and they'd say, well, if we chop everything down to the tinier and tinier parts, eventually we'll reach some parts that can't be chopped anymore. And what shall we call those? We'll call them atoms, okay? Atomos in Greek. A is the alpha privative. Tomos means chop. So it's the atoms are the things that can't be chopped anymore. And of course, in modern science, we have some objects called atoms which can be chopped because later scientists have discovered how to chop them. The basic idea of the atom is that it's too small for anybody to chop. And so since they're unchoppable, they are the basic constituents of all reality. All reality is, it's not water, it's not air, it's these little tiny things that can't be chopped up anymore. Each atom has the qualities of Parmenidean being. It is one, ungenerated, indestructible, changeless, indivisible. However, it is in motion, which Parmenides denied. The atomists believe that motion is characteristic of everything. They disagree with Parmenides on that. But they solved the problem of change. You know, change is supposed to be a difficult problem. what the atomists said was that the atoms change in their relations to each other, but not in their essential nature. I hope that when you listen to Parmenides and when you listen to the atomists, you're seeing some similarity to the way they describe reality to the traditional Christian attributes of God, okay? Ungenerated, unchanging, and so on and so forth. This is what Christians have said about God. Parmenides said these things about being, confusing the creator-creature distinction, by the way, saying that the world is unchanging, whereas Christians believe that God is unchanging and the world is changing. Well, the atomists here are saying that these little tiny things are kind of God-like. I mean, they're always the same, and they don't change their being, but they change their relationships. Sometimes theologians say that about God. So the theologians say, well, God doesn't change in his nature, but God changes in his relationships to human beings, so that when human beings obey him, he's pleased, and when human beings disobey him, he's angry, and so on and so forth. Well, that's a little bit crude, but you can develop that. Anyway, here are the atomists. The atomists wrestled with a philosophical problem that you hear about a lot later on in the history, and that is the problem of determinism. What is the world like? Is the world such a place that every event is caused, is made to happen by some other event, so that one event determines another event? Is that the way the world is, where everything that happens is caused by some other event? That would be a deterministic world. Now, some philosophers don't believe in determinism. Some philosophers believe that there are some events that are not caused in that way. Some things just happen, okay? And if you get into the arguments between Arminians and Calvinists, Arminians have a view of human freedom where human choices, or at least some human choices, just happen. They're not caused by anything. They're not caused by God. They're not caused by their character. They're not caused by their desires. They just kind of happen. And that's called libertarian freedom. Well, that discussion begins way back here in ancient Greece. The atomists started off deterministic. Democritus believed that all events are determined by the motion of atoms. So if you know, if you can chart the way all the atoms are moving, then you can predict everything that's going to happen, because everything happens because of the motions of atoms. Now Epicurus, though, comes along a little bit later, and he generally agrees with Democritus, but he doesn't like this idea of a deterministic world where everything happens according to clockwork. So here's what Epicurus says. Epicurus says, here you have all these atoms, and the atoms move. Of course, they're in motion, and so they move on a downward course. Now, there's a problem here with this. I mean, this is the way the atomists thought of it, that all the atoms kind of move in a downward course. But just think about raindrops that are absolutely parallel. I mean, if they're all coming in a parallel downward course, they're never going to bump into one another. So these atoms never bump into one another. But you need to have them bump into one another, because that's what things are. That's what larger beings are. Why is there a clump of dirt? Well, a clump of dirt is there because a bunch of atoms have stuck together. A bunch of atoms have bumped into one another to form the clump of dirt. And then out of these clumps of dirt will come mountains, and will come streams, and will come trees, and all other reality. But you've got to have atoms bumping into one another in order to have all the things that we're familiar with in the world. Well, how can this happen then? How can they bump into one another? Here's what Epicurus said. Epicurus says, every now and then, you have an atom that kind of swerves from the parallel path, all right? Starts going downward parallel to these, and then all of a sudden, for no reason at all, it just swerves, okay? It's called the Epicurean swerve. It swerves, and when it swerves, it bumps into another atom. Maybe it makes the other atom swerve, I don't know. And so you get a whole lot of atoms swerving, and they bump together, and they form clumps of dirt, and they form mountains and streams and human beings and whatever. That is the origin of the doctrine of free will, okay? That something just happens to take place, that there's a purely accidental swerve. I've heard people sometimes say that you have to have free will in order to have moral responsibility, but I've never seen how purely accidental movement in my head or somewhere else could make me responsible for it. I mean, if my arm were just to go up into the air without my willing it, without any cause, I'd look at it and say, well, isn't that interesting? My arm just went up in the air and I didn't make it happen. It just went up there. How would I take responsibility? I mean, let's say I were walking in front of a bank and all of a sudden my legs just jumped up and carried me inside the bank and I didn't want to go. I didn't have any intention. I didn't make it happen, but my legs just started moving. They swerved. That took me into the bank. And I and somehow something happened to my vocal cords, and I told the bank teller that I wanted money. And something happened to my arm, and it went into my pants, and lo and behold, I have a gun in my hand. Well, all this happened by accident. Well, if it happened by accident, how can I be to blame for that? I mean, the accidental quality of it would seem to take the blame away. But anyway, I digress, perhaps. I don't think that Epicurus went through all that reasoning. But anyway, that's the beginning of the doctrine of free will. That's the beginning of the conversation within philosophy between determinism and free will, or determinism and chance. What we have here with the atomists, I think, is another example, and I think all non-Christian philosophy is like that, another example of rationalism and irrationalism. The atomists are rationalists in that they're trying to define the ultimate nature of the world, not by relating everything to the whole as in Parmenides, but by breaking the world down into its smallest constituents. Remember, it's the human mind that discovers the atom. And it's the human mind, again, that claims to be able to explain exhaustively the nature of the world. And I call that rationalistic. But the rationalism of the system is compromised, since mind is reduced to matter. It's the same problem we had with Thales. You know, Thales reduced the mind to water, so that all my thoughts are like waves. All my thoughts are impersonal. All my thoughts are liquid rather than true and false and so on. So mind is reduced to matter and motion. The Epicurean swerve is a totally irrational event. There's no reason for it. And since all things finally happen by chance. Well, the third group of alternatives to Parmenides that I want to look at today are the Sophists. And I mentioned some names there: Protagoras, Gorgias, Thrasymachus. Thrasymachus said that justice is the interest of the stronger. You can learn that quote for some conversation sometime. Protagoras said that the man is the measure of all things. Interesting quotation. Now, Parmenides, remember, was a rationalist, although he couldn't help developing a philosophy that was alternate to reason. But for the most part, Parmenides was a rationalist. He wanted to have wanted to trust his reason, not his senses. He wanted to trust his reason when any problem came up. The sophists disagree with this. The sophists are not rationalists in this sense, although they love reason. Remember, I told you before that all the Greeks thought that the rational life is the best life. But for the sophists, reason in its best form is critical, okay? Reason in its best form is negative. Reason is critical. It says, I just don't buy it. And so the sophists tended to be skeptics, or they tended to be relativists in their view of knowledge. They don't believe in universal truth. Now, we usually think the truth has got to be universal. If this table is brown, it's brown for me, it's brown for you, it's brown for somebody sitting in the back, it's brown for somebody online, it's brown for all of us, okay? It's true for everybody. But the sophists didn't agree with that. The sophists denied that there is such a thing as universal truth. And the sophists said there is only truth for the individual. You can't say that Washington is the capital of the United States. You can't say that's true. You can say that's true for you, but it might not be true for somebody else. Truth exists only for individual people, and therefore truth is the same as subjective opinion. And that's what Protagoras means with the slogan, man is the measure of all things. So you can see that on this chart here, the sophists are more irrationalist than rationalist. Even though they like reason and they treasure reason, they have relativized the concept of truth so much that we'd have to consider them to be irrationalists rather than rationalists. But nevertheless, they can't stay in that position for very long. I told you before that the rationalist, when he's challenged in a certain direction, he will jump down here, and the rationalist will jump up there. So there's a kind of continual back and forth. So the sophists are rationalists in a way, despite all the irrationalist thrust of sophistic relativism. They are rationalists in this way. To say that man is the measure is to assert a kind of rationalism, assert a kind of irrationalism. It's also to assert that the mind of man is the ultimate standard. So the mind of man is omnicompetent. This leads to an inconsistency. Protagoras admitted that there was no opinion that was truer than another, but he did believe that some were better than others. How can one opinion be better than other than another one when all of them are equally true? Well, you have to understand something about the sophists. The sophists were traveling teachers. They went around to the various cities of Greece, and they taught young men, candidates for public office of some kind, taught them how to get along, taught them how to ingratiate themselves to their superiors, taught them how to play the various games of politics, and so on and so forth. And obviously that sometimes, then as well as now, sometimes that involved lying. And so the truth was not exactly a sacred thing to the sophists. But nevertheless, holding one opinion might be better than holding another opinion. And here's a young man who's trying to advance himself in the Athenian government. Well, for now, he's under the authority of some superiors, and it's got to be to his benefit if he can hold the same views, if he holds the same positions as his superiors, and maybe they will advance him then to higher levels of salary and prestige. So some opinions are better than others, some opinions are better for you. Some opinions, if you know what's good for you, you'll agree with my position. You have to agree with people in order to get along. But there's something inconsistent about this. And by the way, the idea that there's no objective truth and you can only measure truth by what it gives to you, by the benefits of it, that's kind of a pragmatic view of truth. And we find pragmatism, in the 20th century too. So when we talk about Greek philosophy, we're talking about the beginnings of all kinds of things that become predominant in philosophy later on. Well, like all irrationalists, I think Protagoras' position is inconsistent at a deep level, because you have to ask the question, why should we believe what Protagoras says? Is his view, his sophism, his sophistry only true for him, while some other position may be true for me? See, on the one hand, Protagoras is trying to hold a dogmatic view. He's trying to set forth a particular position. But he's relativizing all positions and saying, in effect, none of them are objectively true. How does that work? He's saying that sophism is the case, but still sophism is the case. I know that sophism is the case, but if sophism is the case, then I don't know anything. So this is a perfect example of bouncing around between rationalism and irrationalism. And the reason why people do that is because they don't worship the true God. Well, those are the three thinkers that I've chosen. There are other thinkers that I've not chosen to discuss in this course. But these are the three alternatives to Parmenides. Parmenides says that we should follow reason. Parmenides says there's only one reality. And Parmenides says there's no change. Heraclitus says, yes, there is change. Sophists say our reason is not universally applicable. The atomists say we should be pluralists rather than monists. There are a lot of things in this world. So that shows you how the dialogue gets going on some very important subjects as we carry on our course through the history of philosophy. We'll see others who are rationalists, although they always have a touch of irrationalism. We'll see some that are monists and others that are pluralists, people who believe in change and people who don't believe in change. And some who are determinists and some who are indeterminists, as it's sometimes called. So just keep in mind that these themes keep recurring, and as we trace them through other thinkers, you'll get to understand the issues better, and you may come up with arguments yourselves that work that out. When I come back next time, I want to look at mature Greek philosophy. This section has been called early Greek philosophy. I want to look at mature Greek philosophy when we get back. Mature Greek philosophy is primarily Plato and Aristotle, Plato, Aristotle, and Plotinus, let's say. Those are very important thinkers, and they're much more important than the ones we've been talking about. The ones we've been talking about are usually called pre-Socratics. Socrates, of course, is the great patron saint of philosophers. Socrates said that the unexamined mind is not worth living, and he relentlessly questioned people and with Socratic questions, as they've been called, so that he would pressure them to say what they really thought and to criticize what they had said before and try to come up with serious answers to the problems that they debated. And that led to a whole new era in philosophy. Of course, Socrates didn't write any books, but His pupil was Plato, and Plato described Socrates in great detail, and Aristotle then, and others. The thing about Plato and Aristotle is that they were more reflective. They understood better the defects in their previous views, but they also were able to appreciate the previous views. I think what happens in Plato and Aristotle is that they take all these previous philosophers, Thales, Heraclitus, Parmenides, and they deal with all the questions that these people were asking, and they take what they think is best out of those previous philosophers, and they criticize what they think is not so good. And then they integrate the good thoughts of the past philosophers with some of their own thoughts into a broad system of philosophy. So Plato offers us a major system of philosophy which deals not just with a few subjects, but with a vast number of subjects. Plato is interested in change, but not only about change. Plato's interested in rationality, but not only that. Plato's interested in the good. Plato's interested in society and justice, as the Sophists were, for example. But Plato's able to take all of these different subjects and bring them together into a system. He's concerned about how the world can be stable and yet at the same time changing. And so what he does is that there's one part of his system that he thinks is unchanging, and there's another part of his system that's changing. The world of the forms is unchanging. The world of our experience is constantly changing. So he has a place for Parmenides. He has a place for Heraclitus. And this is typical, I think, of the really great thinkers in philosophy. I think the greatest thinkers in the history of philosophy are Plato, Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, and Kant. Well, give Augustine a honorable mention here, give Hegel honorable mention. But what the great philosophers do is they don't just think about one subject. They don't just hop up on one bandwagon. They're not disciples of somebody in the past. Rather, they are able to combine ideas from their predecessors and show that what Heraclitus says is true, but it should be seen in this context, and what Parmenides says is true, it should be kept in this context. And so we'll have room for all of this, and we'll back away so that we can see the world in a greater depth and greater length. Well, that's also true, I think, of Aristotle. It's also true of Aquinas, also true of Kant. That's why I consider them to be the greatest philosophers. That is, they see most broadly. They bring together thoughts from their predecessors. And so when I begin my next lecture, we'll look at Plato and then Aristotle. Plato was a student of Socrates. Aristotle was a student of Plato. So it's been said that no teacher ever had a greater pupil, and no pupil ever had a greater teacher than Plato and Aristotle. Very interesting relationship between the two. And so we'll talk about those when we get back to work.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.